Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is by David Skinner, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And Peter Pitts has, It's Time for a Moderate Moment. Mark Edmondson wrote, The Point of Retirement, Enlightenment, or at least Calm. L.S. Dugdale has, Old Age Will Be Different in the Robotic Age. And we'll follow that up by one article by Katina Sawyer, I Thought I Was an Ideal Leader, Instead, I Was a Cautionary Tale. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? I used to think I was born at the wrong time. Generation X, like the variable X, might stand for anything or nothing at all. But now I realized how lucky I am. Generation Xers and millennials are set to inherit $4.6 trillion in global real estate over the next 10 years, the Wall Street Journal reported recently. And there have never been so many 401k millionaires. Now there's a demographic that I will gladly cop to. But to see me, you might not realize how filthy rich I am. A lot of my wealth is locked up in real estate, a simple three-bedroom colonial that shakes if you slam the front door. My wife and I bought it at an opportune moment many years ago and cannot afford to move. Transaction costs and mortgage rates being what they are. To conceal our obscene good fortune, we urge our children to go to college in-state and will downsize our little fleet of aging cars as soon as possible to save on insurance and repairs, which these days climbed quickly into the thousands. $4,000 or $5,000 used to mean something. Today, it means you should have been careful pulling out of a parking spot. I do try to keep costs down. My teenage son uses the phrase struggle meals to describe the peanut butter sandwiches I consume while working on a Saturday afternoon. Sure, I work on Saturdays and a bit on Sundays as well, as do many other wealthy people. I also bring my own lunch to the office, shop at outlet stores, and have postponed a gift to take advantage of those sales that immediately happen after Christmas, extending well into the new year, which even to me sounds sad. In The Millionaire Next Door, Thomas J. Stanley and William D. Danko describe wealthy Americans as thrifty saver investors who have long cured themselves of any taste for luxury. Avoiding expense is a big part of how they become so wealthy. I am proud to join their ranks, but I sometimes wonder why I feel so poor. And now we have Peter Pitts, It's Time for a Moderate Moment. I never have to wait in line to vote in an election primary. Even during the most crowded hours, I go straight to the head of the queue. In fact, there is no cure because I am alone. I am a beleaguered Republican of New York's Upper West Side. Whether I'm at a party or walking the dog, when politics comes up, some pearl clutcher always rhetorically asks, how could anyone be a Republican? I politely respond, I'm a Republican, a Rockefeller Republican. Sometimes I'm aggressively challenged, but mostly I become invisible. My deep blue friends and neighbors view me as naive at best and a collaborationist at worst. Back in 2025, hardly anyone had any idea what a Rocky Republican was. For me, it means supporting civil rights and voting rights, a woman's right to choose, a free market economy, small government, free trade, gay rights, Israel, charter schools, thoughtful and informed policy debates, and most important, real world pragmatism and respectful disagreement. Call me a rhino. These are fighting words. I am a staunch, moderate Republican. When we discuss policy rather than politics, my local acquaintances agree with me on almost every issue. Most recently, we all held our noses in recent elections. The rise of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party frightens us. Being a moderate does not mean being militant. It means standing up for what you believe, especially in the face of bomb-throwing demagogues. Being a moderate means thinking for yourself and not kowtowing to socialism or anti-vaccine science denialism. Moderates must own America's generational shift. Millennials and Generation Z know their time has come. They are voting in droves and embracing their newly discovered political empowerment. They should demand to be heard, and their political champions do not have to be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Ilhan Omar, but they don't have to be Republicans of bygone eras either. So where are the young, charismatic, smart alternatives? Moderates must find dynamic new blood. As Nelson Rockefeller once said, it is essential that we enable young people to see themselves as participants in one of the most exciting eras in history and to have a sense of purpose in relation to it. Moderates are being squeezed by potent political extremes on both sides. We don't organize, articulate a policy platform, and recruit the best and brightest across different generations, we will be marginalized and then extinguished entirely. It's already happening. We are the main targets of progressive political correctness, which carries an alarming cultural revolution aroma. It's time for a moderate shift in the spirit of Rocky Republicans. After my hometown's Mandami moment, I've started throwing the question back at my zip code comrades: how can anyone be a Democrat? And now, the point of retirement, enlightenment, or at least calm. Winter is the season when most Americans retire, but this year's retirement wave may be a little smaller than last. There seems to be a growing consensus among the accomplished and influential that you should never surrender your occupation. Peter Thiel thinks retirement is for losers. Ben Shapiro says that 65 is way too early to pack it in. And Elon Musk is not giving up until there are humans on Mars, maybe not even then. Even a half century ago, in her brilliant book, The Coming of Age, Simone de Beauvoir was commending a long life of perpetual action. More projects, more ventures. I get it. I'm 73, love my job at the University of Virginia, and have no immediate plans to walk away. In fact, there was a time I got annoyed when anyone pushed me on the subject. When are you going to retire? You can't teach at UVA forever, can you? When this began about 10 years ago, my answers were sometimes a touch implied. The subtext and sometimes the text was often, mind your own business. In time, he came up with a saner reply. I'll keep working, I say, as long as I can do my job reasonably well. That satisfied most of my interlocutors, and it satisfied me. I was encouraged in this wish to go on by my grad school advisor, Harold Bloom, who kept churning until the end, writing books well into his 80s. It's said he was dictating more criticism on the gurney that carried him to his final operation. He said that he never thought about death and that he would never retire. They can take me out by the heels, I heard him say. By the heels, I wanted to follow his lead. But lately, I've come to think I might be wrong. Retirement may be something that a person truly needs, though not for the standard reason. The established image of a prosperous and happy retirement is well known. One travels to see alluring sights. I wanted to go to Mexico City for a long time. One socializes with friends. 40 years in Charlottesville has brought me many smart and genial ones. One picks up a new sport, though you'll have to keep me out for pickleball. The pock, pock, pock sound sends me around the nearest bend. That all sounds fine, but is it possible that there might be a deeper meaning in the idea of retirement? Maybe it's a phase of development not unlike childhood, youth, and middle age. Those phases have their goal. The child matures, leaves his family, and becomes a part of the human community. The young person finds vocation and maybe a mate. The middle-aged person consolidates his gains and harvests what he's sown. If you ask the Dalai Lama, whose work I've been studying off and on for the last 30 years, what retirement is for, he would, I think, answer that it's for enjoying your life in a decent, compassionate way. But he would also tell you that retirement is about getting ready to die. To the Dalai Lama, all of life should contain some preparation for death, but that preparation should become more important in the last phase. According to the Dalai Lama, you want to leave the world in as calm and composed a way as possible. You want to be fully present at your own passing with a clear mind and, if possible, not clouded by medication. You want to do all you can to move beyond the very human fear of death and get as close to tranquility as you can. Yet you can do this through meditation. While you meditate, you brood on the impertinence of all things, including yourself, and envision yourself as a corpse lying out on a bier, all life gone. This will happen. It's inevitable. Hindus commend a phase of life that they call sannyasa. In it, an elderly person gives up ownership of worldly possessions. He, usually a male, but not always, leaves home, puts on a saffron robe, picks up a staff and a beggar's bowl, and begins a life of wandering. He puts aside distractions so he can focus on the life of his spirit and the prospect of death. If I'm still churning away in my professional life, it will be hard, maybe impossible, to prepare for what is coming. It may seem noble never to retire from work and think about the end, but doing so may make you panic when the prospect of the end becomes manifest, especially if you feel it has come too soon. And who wouldn't feel that way? Montaigne said that everyone believes he has 10 years left to live, no matter how dire his condition. But death comes when it will. Why does it matter if we go out calmly or kicking and squalling? The Dalai Lama believes that it will be easier to bear if we pass calmly to the next life and if death does not take us completely by surprise. There will be less pain for us overall, less suffering, as dramatic rehearsals make the play easier to perform. Rehearsing our end might make it smoother. There's also the effect we have on the people who love us and whom we love. No one wants to be remembered as a ranting, near madman or woman, though on a certain level, there is plenty of reason to rail against death. In his best-known poem, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, Dylan Thomas passionately urges his father to fight against death to the last breath. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. A friend of mine, a good and kind woman, spent her last days raging at everyone close to her. She told them her very worst thoughts about them. She could not contain her rage against the doctor, a friend who she felt had misdiagnosed her. She did some serious damage to her family, not irreparable damage, but serious. As for me, I can't pretend to be an expert on this daunting subject. There are days when I think I'll be teaching at the University of Virginia nearly forever. I believe I have 10 years left, and that next year I'll still have another decade to go. At other times, wiser times, I believe, I'm able to take the guru seriously and begin to imagine the inevitable end. Begin? No better than that. A guru is one who dispels illusions, and there is perhaps no illusion so insistent or potentially more harmful to the individual than the illusion that he will live forever. To enjoy a comfortable retirement and still follow the Dalai Lama's advice, we may need to follow Shakespeare's Prospero, a magician who tells us what he will do with his wand and book of incantations when he retires. I'll break my staff, bury it certain fathoms in the earth, and deeper than did ever plummet sound, I'll drown my book. He also resolves to think regularly on death. Perhaps this can be done in the midst of the hurly-burly of the professional world, but it's not easy. It will be hard for me to go without the class preparation, those lively students, and even, I think, the grading of papers. But choosing retirement may be the best way to get ready for what is to come. And now, an article, interesting comparison, by L.S. Dugdale. Old age will be different in the robotic age. America faces an elder care crisis. We have a rapidly aging population, a declining birth rate, and a caregiving workforce that is burning out and increasingly facing deportation. From 2023 to 2024, the number of adults 65 and older grew by 3.1%, while the number of children under 18 shrank. In nearly half of United States counties, seniors outnumber children. Half of Americans 65 and older have nothing at all saved for future living assistance. We must start thinking about who will take care of grandma and grandpa. For most families, outsourcing elder care is prohibitively expensive, upwards of $75,000 a year for a home health aide and well over $100,000 for a nursing home. Only when assets run down will Medicaid start footing the bill, though many wrongly assume Medicare will help. Nearly a third of Americans 65 and older live alone. I believe that robots will assume the care of many of them. A robot would ideally be a one-time expense requiring minimal maintenance and receiving updates through cloud computing technology. A limited number of friends and relatives would struggle to provide unpaid stopgap care to aging adults. By contrast, a robot could function around the clock. I've treated elderly patients who had been found wandering the streets, lying in their own excrement, or simply dehydrated because of gaps in care. A tireless robot, made possible through gains in battery life and the ability to self-charge, could mitigate such problems, but robot caregivers leave all of us with ethical questions. Robot-led elder care could further isolate seniors who might be better served by community activity in an assisted living or nursing home. Although social isolation remains a real problem, robots need not mean loneliness. Reliable robotic companions could accompany seniors outside the home for strolls or to community events. They could enhance rather than diminish socialization. And while actual human contact is preferable, it has real drawbacks. Human caregivers can lose their tempers, but robots are unlikely to have that problem. In a recent study, observers found artificial intelligence-generated responses to be more empathic, validating, and compassionate than those of humans. A robot with AI-assisted voice technology could potentially understand emotion and intent, clarify instructions, and respond to commands in real time. But where will that lead us? If I know that grandma has her bot, will I opt not to drop by after work when I'm exhausted? Will the neighbors stop checking on her? As her faculties dwindle, will she feel more at ease with the robot than with her family? Robots may threaten ordinary human interactions while obfuscating what it means to be human. They will take note of the nurses and aides, and in some cases, provide the emotional support that used to come from family and friends. This runs a real risk of undercutting part of our humanity. Robots might seem like inhumane stopgaps to care for aging elders, but once this technology proves itself, it will present genuine solutions to crises of affordability, reliability, and access. Its advantages over human caregivers, who are expensive and whose numbers are insufficient, will be real and important. This may all sound like science fiction, but I do not think it is. New Amazon robots have an incredibly fine sense of touch and can pick up objects with precisely the right amount of pressure. Tesla's humanoid robots can now accomplish more than 1,500 tasks, their hands capable of executing 60 of the 100 distinct movements the human hand can perform. Elon Musk projects they will be available later this year, although he's been wrong in the past and recently lost top robotic talent. But if robots can now fold laundry, serve food, sweep the floor, operate computers, talk, walk, and dance, it's plausible that soon they will help our elders out of bed and give them sponge baths. One estimate places the cost of a humanoid robot at $20,000. Not bad compared with a nursing home. As someone with Luddite tendencies, I still find the whole idea a bit absurd. Science fiction has been making promises and issuing warnings about humanoid machines since before the Czech writer Karel Kopek introduced the word robot in a 1920 play. Caregiving robots still seem too futuristic or clunky to be of real value. Previous attempts have ended in failure. Maybe the next one will too. But we are getting closer, and I think I'll soon be writing prescriptions for elder care robots. This will present humans with real choices. The original Luddites, English textile workers who objected to mechanical looms and destroyed them in protest, believed they were fighting for their very existence. Robot caregivers may force a similar reckoning. But rather than destroying robots in protest, we must keep them in their rightful place. Kopek's word robot came from the Czech for forced labor. The term gives us a direction. Designating robots to labor for us, programming them to treat humans with compassion. That is our decision as their creators. By contrast, we human beings are not programmed but free. We must choose to be kind and compassionate to one another. The introduction of robotic caregivers does not nullify this responsibility, but it makes it more urgent. And now we do have one more. I thought I was an ideal leader. Instead, I was a cautionary tale. I've always identified as an achiever, pushing myself to collect clear signals of success from grade to promotion. Having come from a family of hardworking entrepreneurs who taught me the value of hustle and the impracticability of rest, I suppose it was inevitable that I would take pride in being an overworker. Here, I was always exhausted, but I told myself I would relax when I finally achieved enough. Yet, my to-do list always seemed to grow, but I convinced myself that was okay. Since my drive was not about competition or insecurity, but about my own growth and being a role model to others, my resume duly glittered with honors and degrees. Given just how invested I was in being an ideal mentor, it perhaps makes sense that my wake-up call came from one of my mentees. A few years ago, I was encouraging a particularly talented student at the University of Arizona, where I work, to pursue a PhD and rise to senior leadership in consulting. His response was shocking. I always wanted to be a leader until I saw you doing it. He pointed out the late night email, the early morning replies, and how my calendar was always packed with few breaks. He questioned how I found time for myself, my family, my friends. Work is important, but so is living my life, he said. If this is what it takes, I don't think I want to do it. Critique was mortifying. I thought I was a proud example of the benefits of hard work. Instead, I had become a cautionary tale. As my students' words rattled around my head, I began to recognize the personal toll of my hustle mentality. I was so consumed with checking boxes and sending emails that I had not been eating right, sleeping well, or spending real time with people outside of work, not even my husband. If I kept prizing work above all else, what was else even look like? Hoping for space to reflect, I booked a retreat. After a yoga class, I complimented a fellow participant on how flawlessly she used every pose. The retreat leader pulled me aside and asked gently why I was so focused on someone else's achievements. Apparently, I'd managed to turn a space for personal mindfulness into yet another arena for competition. Clearly, unlearning hustle culture would not be easy. I began small. I carved out an hour each morning for exercise, coffee, and a calm start to my day, which meant going to bed earlier and resisting the urge to catch up on emails at night. Even the small change was hard. There were always people expecting a response. But I began to see how sending emails before bed only invited more the next morning. It turned out I could just break the cycle and everything would still be okay. Instead of seeing weekend as a way to get a jump on the week, I started using this time to actually relax and be with people I care about. This was much more fun. I also felt more restored when it was time to get back to work. I started working outside when the weather was nice, stopped scheduling calls during my commute, and gave myself time to just think. My ideas became sharper, and I felt less stressed. I also saw that nothing fell apart just because I took a step back. As a first-generation college student made good, I used to hold up my life as a roadmap for others. Now I no longer encourage students to follow my lead. Instead, I assure them that there is no one path to success. I add, with sincere humility, that I am still figuring out my own way forward. That brings us to the end of today's article. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.